Welcome to Say Yes to the Chef. Our guest today is Susie Gott-Segaray. She's the director of the Seasonal School of Culinary Arts based in Asheville, North Carolina. I'm Chef Janice Escott. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, I'm Chef Kelly Taylor. How are you today?
We're all very good today.
Welcome, Susie.
Hi, Susie. Welcome.
Thank you. I don't know whether to say thank you, merci, bonjour, oui, to the chef,
all of the above. That's exactly right. So your background is wonderful, and we really would like to hear about that.
Obviously, there's some French in there somewhere. So tell us about, where you grew up, and then how you made your way to France eventually, and then your way back.
Okay. Well, I'm a melting pot of all kinds of influences, a mutt, as one might say. Born in Madison County, Western North Carolina, which is one of the, most rural farming communities of North Carolina, and I spent the first couple decades of my life there, and then the next couple decades in France through kind of a fluke of music connections. I went over playing music and came back teaching cooking.
It's all related.
Making use of what's at hand in each environment. So I was very fortunate to grow up in this amazing part of Appalachia where all my neighbors kept gardens and cows, and there was a dirt wagon track going through the community. There was no paved road when my parents moved down from the north. So although I was born there, my parents were from elsewhere. So I always had that somewhat outside perspective. And when I went to France 20 years later, following the music trail, I went over playing bluegrass. I was, again, when I settled there, the outsider looking at things in a small French community from a different perspective. So I've always kind of had that duality of being from one, living in one place and thinking about it from elsewhere. And it's amazing how much you take for granted and how the longer you are away from the place that you are from, the more you become what you were to begin with. So it's funny to come full circle back around to living in Appalachia again, and only fitting at the same time. Obviously, there are many similarities between Appalachia and France in using the products that you have at hand and making the best of what you have, and highlighting them in a way so that they really just taste like what they are. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the magic that I have tried to convey in the new book that I have coming out, which we'll talk about a little bit more later, I think, Appalachian Appetite, which is a marriage in a way of this Appalachian culture and French treatment of ingredients, and what I like to jokingly call Frappalachian cuisine, for lack of a better term.
Word.
Yeah, that is great. We can't wait to talk about that. I think that so you said that they're kind of similar in ways, Appalachia and France. I wouldn't think that. Like, I don't know that much about either one, to be honest. I've never lived in Appalachia and I've never lived in France. So to me, they seem very different. So how are they more similar in ways that you notice because you had the experience of being in both, other than using what you have?
Well, I would say that the people who produce food are, in France, revered in a way that we had sort of for a while forgotten to revere them here stateside. And now, at current day, we almost take for granted already this sustainable local approach to eating, which has become a byword only recently again here. But anyway, these are things on which the Appalachian culture has been based for a long time, and the French culture as well. And yes, it might seem very different, but when you get out into the country in France, it's very much like Appalachia. You know, you see these old farmers with their caps, and they're a little bit surly. And when you get to the heart of things, they all love fat, be it bacon fat or goose fat. And that's what makes things delicious, and they don't use it sparingly.
Ah, so it's their love of fat, That's what really binds us together. That's hilarious.
And this is not at all the direction I intended to take this conversation, but
but we always end up with that anyway, right. Especially in cooking.
So in France, there are different regions with different focuses on their food, from the north to the south and the east to the west. And I'm guessing that the Appalachian is the same. I don't know. I mean, do you see a difference between, I mean, it spreads a long way. Let's talk about that first. What is the geography of the Appalachian?
Well, it's been defined a couple of different ways. ARC, the Appalachian Regional Commission, defines it in one way, which is more of an economic definition. And they attribute 13 states to Appalachia, all of
yes.
West Virginia, of course, and large parts of other states.
And all the way to Maine, I think. Is that right?
Their definition stops, I believe, in southern New York.
However,
the Appalachian Trail and the Appalachian chain geographically goes
all the way
up to Maine and even farther into the southern part of Canada there. Okay. So I'm defining it personally.
Okay.
From Mississippi, where ARC, the Appalachian Regional Commission starts its definition, from Mississippi to Maine, which is the end of the Appalachian Trail, even though it essentially goes up beyond. That's my definition for the book that I've just come up with, trying to represent each of these states that the Appalachian Mountain chain traverses.
It's an interesting way of thinking about it because it's not what comes to mind when I think about Appalachia. I think more southern, you know, it bluegrass, like what you started with. I just have this whole different image in my head, and Maine and New York are not one of them. So it's really fascinating to have a whole different perspective. And the cookbook and your background is, taking all of it into account, which seems like a very big undertaking.
I wish I had years more to spend with it. There will be follow-up.
More.
Right. So this is a start. So the book is called Appalachian Appetite, and so it's an appetizer to thinking about Appalachia in a larger perspective. And it's funny because while I was writing this, my son was hiking the Appalachian Trail. He spent 5 months going from Georgia to Maine, anyway.
Oh, Georgia to Maine.
And I was thinking about that long expense and getting his story of what the trail felt like as I was writing about the cooking of the region. And yes, we do tend to think of Appalachia as more southern-based and perhaps economically disadvantaged as the movies Deliverance and other movies have represented it for the public at large. However, that is one sliver that the media has chosen to latch onto and make the definition. And by and large, the mountain folks, I suppose you could say more than Appalachian, it's mountain people.
Yes.
And mountain people all over the world have things in common, this subsistence existence and making do with what they have, and often a fierce loyalty that goes out of or comes from partially from where they might have come from. In Appalachia, that's often Scotch-Irish and a mixture of that with the native peoples. And they are fiercely independent and also look out for each other and for their families in a way that other cultures don't necessarily represent.
Yeah, I would imagine that when you live in the mountains, I mean, you do have to be much more sustainable. I mean, you need to be able to be more independent, especially before we had roads and we had all of the things that would have made it a little easier to get around between the neighbors, because there's some distance between the neighbors, perhaps. I find it really interesting, too, when I moved here a while ago, the difference in the accent in the mountains. And that's when I found out this Scottish sort of ancestry. And that sort of added this whole other accent to North Carolina, the people who live in the mountains in North Carolina. And I just found that fascinating because, you know, you have that Scottish accent, which is pretty strong as well. And then you have this other, because people think of a southern accent and they think of one accent. But that's just not true, is it? So we have to actually take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more with Susie Gott-Segure. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back. You're listening to Say Yes to the Chef on WCHL Chapelboro 97.9 FM. My name is Kelly Taylor. I'm here with my co-host, Janice Escott, and our guest today is Susie Gott-Segaray. She is the director of the Seasonal School of Culinary Arts, which is based in Asheville, North Carolina. And before we left, we were talking about Appalachia and what that means, geography-wise, and a little bit more about just the culture, in a way. And you have written a cookbook, which we kind of alluded to in the earlier segment. But I wanted to just have you talk a little bit about the cookbook that you have coming up and when it's going to be released, and what people can expect to have to see in it. And the name, Appalachian Appetite, that's the name of the book, correct?
That's correct. Thank you, Kelly.
I forgot, you know, we didn't say, too, anywhere where people can go up online, maybe, while they're listening, if they want to get information. Maybe we should do that now and we'll do it again. Can you give us a website if anyone wants to go check out more information about you and your book and anything, Seasonal School of Culinary Arts? So go ahead and give that to them.
Okay, well, I have way too many websites, but the principal one for the culinary activity is Seasonal School. It's for the Seasonal School of Culinary Arts, and the address is schoolofculinaryarts.org. Mm-hmm. I also operate a truffle festival in Asheville in the wintertime, and that is, AshevilleTruffle.com, and wine events throughout the year, and that is the Asheville, that's simply AshevilleWineExperience.com.
You are a busy lady.
On Twitter, you can find me at Seasonal Tastes, and otherwise, Facebook is where you'll find information about the book immediately, and that is under Susie Gott-Segaray. So
we should spell your name then.
Information than you need.
No.
S-E-G-U-R-E-T.
Yes. Okay.
Susie, S-U-S-I, Gott, G-O-T-T.
Yep. Great. Okay. Now we got it all out.
Yes.
That's good. Okay. So tell us about the new book.
So the book is called Appalachian Appetite, Recipes from the Heart of America. And why choose this particular subject? A couple of years back, Nordic cuisine was all the rage. Mm-hmm. And what struck me when everybody started talking about this unique cuisine that was Nordic cuisine is that it's exactly what we have done in Appalachia throughout the ages. It's taking the ingredients at hand, which are often ingredients that other people would cull or not even think of using, and making the most of them, perhaps with just a little bit of accent of meat here and there, because we can. Nordic cooking makes use of things like pine needles and mm-hmm. lichens and things that they have. We have our own set of ingredients and playing with them in an original way for a long, long time. And, of course, a lot of foraging is involved in what we think of as the indigenous cuisine, and that is coming back to the fore now, the Appalachian chefs who are taking the cuisine to, I think, a new palatable level for the current day person who has watched all these food networks and expects bells and whistles at every step. They're really making use of ingredients that the indigenous people used, and all that woven in with what people have come to think of as traditional Appalachian recipes, which involve lots of pork and chicken and gravy and biscuits and all those good things. So I think that we... Appalachia is really the kind of the not the breadbasket, but we have more ingredients in Appalachia than just about anywhere in the country, and I would say probably than anywhere in the country. We have this really rich botanical
environment
to draw from. So there's no limit to the kinds of things that can be done with old recipes to make them interesting to new chefs who aspire to using all their
creativity and their skills. Yeah. What are the ingredients? Like when you're talking about unique ingredients and things that you might find there that you wouldn't find other places, or maybe you find them but people aren't using them.
Right.
Can you give us some examples of what you mean?
Well, some of the ingredients that not everyone has had the pleasure of cooking with are ramps. Of course, the wild leek that are plentiful in the forests in April, particularly. Morel mushrooms, chanterelles, these are mushrooms that are plentiful in April and in the late summer as well for the chanterelles.
You have to have a special mushroom hunting. Right. I can imagine people going out in the woods now and looking for mushrooms.
Well, morels are very easily recognizable. All you have to do is look at a photo. You pretty much can't make a mistake on that. The chanterelle, there are some lookalikes. Look for the apricot scent. They really smell like apricots. And so if you find one that smells like an apricot, you're pretty darn safe.
Okay.
There's lots of information.
Right. There's lots of information.
That's a good little tip, though.
And pictures. There's lots of
exactly.
pictures.
Yeah, but pictures, you know. I don't know.
Different some people have different judgments.
That little secret about it smelling like apricots. It's wonderful.
Lots of wild greens. Turkey's foot. It's this wonderful little three-leafed green that has a purple back, and it tastes peppery in a salad. You can eat violet leaves and, of course, violet flowers, dandelions, people know about that. Pokeweed, which has to be parboiled and you pour off the liquid a couple times to get rid of what would otherwise be toxic to some people.
How did they figure that out? I don't understand sometimes how people figure things out. Like, what did you just test it in between and somebody got sick? I mean, it's very fascinating to me. Do you know any of the history of how they figured that out?
different people have different tolerances. So what kills one person might not kill the next person. So you can't necessarily believe the person who's gone before you. I would say it's probably a bit of trial and error. Mm-hmm. And it tastes delicious.
Mm-hmm. So. Is there a Native American influence in that? It just occurred to me that there might be, and they would be excellent teachers.
Well, definitely, and they may have been the ones who did the testing. Certainly, various nuts like the bitter nuts, the butter nuts, the hickory nuts that people eat that are found wild in the forest, the beech nuts, which are time-consuming to gather. Of course, the black walnuts, that's a little bit more common, but still delicious in a way that most people don't get to taste because it takes work to get them out of their shell.
And to go pick them up. And, I mean, all of that is a lot of work. Mm-hmm. Foraging is a lot of work, but so is farming. I mean, all of it, getting your food is generally a lot of work. I mean, people are so used to going to the grocery store that they forget that actually when you want to go get your food for real from where it grows, it's a lot of work.
Even going to the grocery store sometimes is a lot of work. We have to read all those labels and decide what we want.
So what are the traditional recipes then? You said that there are some traditional recipes in the area. Can you give us some examples of that?
Sure. Well, something like chicken and dumplings, which makes use of essentially a biscuit recipe thrown in a pot that where chicken has been stewing. And there are numerous different ways to do this, and every family has a different version.
Mm-hmm. For every part of it, like for every part of the chicken and dumplings. I mean, like every single part of it is different.
So how do you do the broth? Yes. How do you treat the chicken? How do you make the dumplings? Do you use Bisquick?
Yes.
Do you use Martha White?
It's just fascinating,
White
isn't
Lily,
it?
Right. Yeah. It's very much a family tradition, and recipes have been passed on by word of mouth because that was the best way to do it, and everyone interprets them differently. And I have a very hard time, actually, myself. One of the biggest challenges in writing a cookbook is having to put measurements down because I don't measure. Most of the people I know don't measure. Mm-hmm. We all cook by feel. And if you have to encapsulate something, the risk is that people are going to take this verbatim and then they're going to do it this way and they'll never have these delightful surprises that come from playing with ingredients yourself. So I try to make clear that, yes, this is how I will write it down on this particular day, but please play with it because the kind of flour you use makes a difference. How heavy-handed or light-handed you are makes a difference. Yes. How fast you stir is going to make a difference. Mm-hmm. And it's going to come out differently no matter whether you measure precisely or not from one person to another.
That is the beauty of cooking, really. I mean, that you can taste the cook. You taste the cook's hand in it, definitely. And I think that's a really good thing, but it is confusing in a cookbook. Because people buy the cookbook and they want to follow it to a T and they think they are. But like what you said, what your handful, how you stir, to describe that is very difficult. So we have to take another break. You're listening to Say Yes to the Chef, and we will return in just a few minutes, so don't go anywhere. This is Say Yes to the Chef. My name is Kelly Taylor, and I'm here with my co-host, Janice Escott, and our guest today is Susie Gott-Segaray. She is the director of the Seasonal School of Culinary Arts based in Asheville, North Carolina, with great jaunts abroad to France and other places, which we will talk to her a little bit about, that wonderful culinary school. But before we do that, I'd like to just touch base real quickly about the cookbook you were writing, Appalachian Appetite. And I wanted to just talk about when that will be released so people can know when to keep an eye out for that. So when are we expecting to see that?
29th of November is the current release date, at least before the holidays. So, yeah, something you can throw in your basket if you wish.
Add to the Christmas piles of gifts.
That sounds like a great idea.
And you'll be on a, I'm sure, be making appearances around the state.
That is the plan. So, yes, look out for possibilities in bookstores or cooking class locations. And, of course, there will be events happening in and around Asheville around the release date, too. I hope to gather a good number of the chefs who contributed recipes to have a release party, and so that readers can get a chance to meet those chefs and ask them specific questions about their backgrounds and how they see this whole Appalachian cuisine and where they see it going, and how we're going to ride the wave that is has been building steadily towards recognition of this culture and the wonderful finesse that is possible to use to embellish the dishes of the standard Appalachian ingredients that people don't necessarily think of in as much of a forward-looking way as we are now considering. My tongue tangled up here right now.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, lately I'd say over the last, I don't know how many years, you know, the Southern cuisine has sort of been this new, you know, golden child of cuisine around the country. So it's nice to have another spotlight on another type of cuisine in America. Because, you know, it's hard to identify what is American cuisine.
Right.
So I think it's fascinating for people to be able to see the real nuances between, like, states and then within states, how different. I mean, if you're in North Carolina, I had to learn quickly about barbecue when I moved here. And, you know, the rules about barbecue. So, and I think it's really interesting for other people to start to learn about that. And having a cookbook out there is definitely a good way for people who don't live in the area to find out more. So we're appreciative that you did that. And you said you had other chefs contribute. How many chefs contributed to the cookbook? Recipes.
I need to make a count, but a couple of dozen. I would like to have had a whole lot more. Obviously, there's only so much response you can get in a limited amount of time, and so I consider this an invitation to myself to follow up and have more chefs involved in a follow-up tome to this. But in any case, I've tried to get a lot of different perspectives and. Take this in a direction that is beyond what I might have done myself. And I think of Appalachia. I think of certainly the South as the heart of America. Of course, I'm from here. So of course I'm a little bit biased. But I also think, I really think of Appalachia as the heart of the South. It's this nugget. It's just this nugget of absolute wonderful tastiness and something that deserves a lot more recognition than it has had in the past. And I think it's really the time is ripe to focus on recipes from this area.
Well, and you've been doing this, I would assume, in some ways at the culinary school. Is that correct?
Sure.
I mean, I would assume, because how long have you had the Seasonal School of Culinary Arts?
I've been doing this for over 12 years now. And I choose a different theme every session, so we've covered lots of different culinary styles. Asheville is an incredible, rich place to draw from chefs. So, at the beginning, I had chefs coming in from all parts of the globe. I had chefs coming down from New York and chefs coming in from California, chefs coming in from Paris. And then I realized that Asheville had so many chefs, I might as well just keep it all local. So the session that I do there in July is all Asheville chefs and all Asheville produce and as many North Carolina beverages as I can include. Of course, we have a richness of wines in North Carolina now with over 100 wineries. And
do we now? We have 100. Oh, my goodness.
And, of course, we have lots of distilleries that are cropping up here and there. Mm-hmm. And we won't even go in the direction of beer, which breweries are everywhere.
Exploding.
Asheville being Beer City USA for so many years in a row. Mm-hmm. But then the other sessions that I do in Ithaca in the fall and in Sonoma in the winter and in Paris in the spring, I try to keep those all local too. So rather than make ingredients travel and chefs travel, I like to take people to the sites and have them experience things in the environment where the ingredients are grown.
How did you pick those places?
I wanted something north, south, east, west.
Sounds good.
And I had connections in all those places. So those were doable. And Ithaca, of course, is kind of like a mini Asheville. There's, of course, the culinary program that's connected with Cornell University. And there are the wineries that surround the Finger Lakes. And there is a wealth of farms and creameries. So it's a grand place to be. And, of course, in the fall coloring is magical there. Sonoma, I have chef friends out in Sonoma, and similarly, there are amazing wines without getting into the really busyness of Napa. Mm-hmm. So not everybody goes to Sonoma. And it's,
what season do you go?
I go there in December.
In December, oh.
And, of course, the creameries are wonderful. There as well. And farmers, and I have chefs that host hands-on sessions and wine dinners in their homes. Mm-hmm. And Paris, of course, that's...
That's Paris.
I lived outside of them. Right. I was in France for 20 years, actually an hour south of Paris in the wheat-growing belt, but have friends throughout Paris who host different parts, different components of the days that we spend there. So we take people wine tasting in caves under the Louvre, and we have hands-on sessions
fancy.
And culinary schools in various different areas of Paris, and then a trip out in the country. Sometimes I've taken people out to Manet's garden, and we bicycle along this path along the river, along the Seine, and shop at the local market and have a picnic along the river as well. And then
and you have a real
see
connection
Manet's kitchen.
With Paris also, with the Le Cordon Bleu?
I did. When I started doing this culinary school, it's funny because my background was not in the culinary field. I grew up playing music. I grew up actually eating amazing produce because I lived on a farm, a self-sufficient farm, and we grew everything we ate. We went to town twice a year and lived on $200 a year.
Oh, my
parents
God.
Grew everything, so the whole nine yards of the vegetables. We had cows, chickens, pigs, ducks, geese, goats, bees, made alcoholic beverages of various different sorts. And so it was subsistence farming, and we were so busy that we never really got to the last step, which is how you present the food. So we had this amazing stuff, but it was just kind of, boiled or fried or thrown on the table, and that was the element missing. And when I went to live in France following the musical trail in the early 80s, sometime around, I went back and forth several times in the 80s, this last step came to fruition, and I started thinking, what good is it? We spend our entire lives devoted to feeding our families and our friends. We devote our lives to our education so that we can get money, so that we can buy food to feed our families. But we don't necessarily go that last step of how to make the food delicious and how to make it really a gathering point around the table. And that's what the French do so well. So then I realized there was something to be done in culinary and taste education back here, and started the cooking school, and then had to quick get some credentials because I wasn't born with those under my wing. So, of course, living in France, I went to the Cordon Bleu and ended up with a gastronomy degree through Les Hautes Etudes du Goût, which is a marriage of Cordon Bleu intensives and linked in with a university in Reims for a sort of a larger taste education. So I wish I could say I had done the entire Cordon Bleu cooking experience. It was more theoretical and linked in very much with taste education. So then I lucked into writing a thesis with Helvétis as my mentor. Helvétis, who's considered the father of molecular gastronomy and who's a chemist in Paris.
We have to take a break, actually. We will get right back to that when we return. Thanks. This is Say Yes to the Chef. I am Kelly Taylor with my co-host Janice S. Scott, and you're listening to WCHL 97.9, Chapelboro. Our guest today is Susie Gott-Sarraguay. She's the director of the Seasonal School of Culinary Arts based in Asheville, North Carolina. And before we left, talked about the many other places where you have wonderful programs, Ithaca, Paris, and Sonoma. So you could probably go up on your website and see when those programs are starting because they're in different seasons. Hence the name Seasonal School of Culinary Arts. And before we left off, too, we were talking about sort of your studies and how you got into culinary. And we left with the when you were talking about getting your thesis and how you it sounded almost like you just sort of stumbled into that. But I don't know. So tell us where you left off, Susie, with the thesis.
Sure. Well, I was fortunate to have had music as an opener. Music and food, I believe, are two common denominators in any cultural crossings. So these have been my two leading passions throughout my life. And it's funny because I'm constantly looking for the links between music and food, and they seem like two vastly different subjects, but there are lots of ways in which they cross. Helvétis, who's, again, considered the father of molecular gastronomy and has done lots of work with chefs such as Pierre Gagnaire in France, has moved on from the molecular gastronomy concentration to what he calls la cuisine note à note, or note-by-note cooking. Mm. That's been his next passion because people have taken molecular gastronomy in all kinds of different directions that weren't necessarily his original intention, and it's gotten kind of beyond his original scope, which was essentially putting food on the table for people you love in a way that communicates that love. So to get back to the note-by-note cooking, he equates flavors to musical notes. And,
That's interesting.
So if you combine different flavors, such as you would combine musical notes to make a chord, you have this taste chord, which is equivalent to a musical chord, and then you combine those chords into a dish, or in music it would be to a musical piece, and then you combine those dishes to form a symphony.
That's fascinating.
So I, of course, latched on to that early, and happily he agreed to be my mentor for the thesis that I wrote called
That's
The Question
fantastic.
Of Taste, which thinks of taste in lots of different directions, and how we define taste, it's beyond the taste that crosses our palate. It's our taste for different elements in our life, such as our taste in music, our taste in theater, our taste in art, our taste in home decoration, our taste in men or women, where we choose to live. So thinking of all these different taste elements and how they define how we are.
Can you
what
read this?
Me.
Can I read this? It would be an interesting read.
Well, that's something I need to make available to the general public. Another book
good
subject
idea.
Here.
I think it would be fascinating. Yes. It would be a fascinating read. Let us know when you make that book.
Okay,
and we can have a whole other discussion on taste because that's a long discussion. I mean, there's a lot of really interesting things about taste that people don't probably think about. But that's all right. We also wanted to talk about you have some wine credentials. I'm not sure what they're called exactly. The Certified Specialist of Wine, is that what the certification is? And what does that mean?
Sure. Well, it just basically means that I've
drank some wine.
Right. Answered a whole lot of questions correctly, despite the amount of wine I drank. there is so much to know about wine. It's such a vast subject, and it's a step in the path of becoming a sommelier, which I would love to achieve sometime in my lifetime. That requires drinking a whole lot more wine to have the taste references as well as the historical and chemical and botanical references. So part of it, of course, is theoretical, but what it all boils down to is what tastes good and how you combine these different elements to have wine that will last throughout the ages and make you remember it throughout the ages.
And how it relates to food.
Exactly.
Because it does.
It certainly does. So a good wine can, of course, enhance any dish, and a good dish can enhance the right wine as well. It goes in both directions. And wine is very much a food. In France, it is very much a food. We have, for so long in the States, we've been hampered by Prohibition and the aftermath of Prohibition, and of course then the religious, perhaps, constrictions in celebrating with wine. Of course, in France, wine is part of the religious celebration, and so I feel like it's time we came back around and recognized wine as an essential element to enhancing the food that we put on our table. And I'd like to bring the conversation around to Les Dames d'Escoffier, which is what brings me to Chapel Hill at this moment. So thank you for including me on this wonderful yes to the chef. Lots of yeses to say today, and which is how I met Kelly. Les Dames d'Escoffier being a philanthropic group that is comprised of women who are united to help other women in getting the word out a little bit more about what they do, because traditionally the culinary world has been largely a man's world. And, of course, we are named after a man, Auguste Escoffier, which is somewhat ironic.
I think it's hilarious.
However, this is a man who's inspired men and women to achieve wonderful things in the name of cuisine throughout the years, Auguste Escoffier being a referential figure in the creation of cookbooks and recipes.
And culinary schools.
Yeah, culinary schools, and also in creating the brigade system after which our kitchens have been modeled, which refers to the specialization of, say, one person who concentrates in vegetables, one who concentrates in the treatment of meat, associé, somebody who's dedicated just to the making of delicious sauces, which I will get back to women in the kitchen. And I think that this is one area in which women excel in creating these sauces that link all the elements together. Because the sauce is the finishing touch. It is the link of one dish to another, a whole experience. It's that bringing together of elements. And I think that's, yes, as I said, a place where women really excel and are adding another level to what has been a man's world throughout the years.
It has. And I was happy to meet Susie there, too. It's a great organization. We've just been in North Carolina. This is our first year to have a chapter here, but the chapters but the organization is now turning 30 this year. So hopefully you'll see more around the state from the Les Dames, but we do plan on doing a lot more philanthropic things, a lot more events, so that we can involve people in more of the education about culinary and what it means. And I really never put the connection together between women being good at sauces. That is, I'm still back there at that part of the conversation. Because women are good at bringing things together like that, and so that's a really fascinating, I love your insight on that. I appreciate that. I would have never thought of that. So thank you for that. But you also have, real quickly, we have like a minute or two left, I wanted to talk about the other events you have, wine dinners and the Truffle Festival, which is a lot to fit in 2 minutes. And I'm sorry to say we have to do that. But tell us quickly about the wine events first and then the truffle.
Well, the wine events I call Asheville Wine Experience, or AWE, if you look at the website, again, ashevillewineexperience.com. I have yet to schedule something for this year. However, the Truffle Festival, AshevilleTruffle.com, if you look at the website, will be coming up, and I will soon be posting things about the upcoming session, which will be this winter. I have yet to choose the date. It will be either end of January or sometime in February, possibly the beginning of March, but right there for that end of the truffle season. And it will be a weekend of dinners and truffle workshops or lectures in Asheville that will be focused on what you can do with the truffle as a chef and on how to appreciate that taste and recognize the value of truffles and the fact that we can now grow truffles in
North
Carolina.
It's amazing. Yes.
Which is a subject for another conversation.
It is. It's a fascinating subject. And we've been to a truffle farm. It was really fascinating. But it is a food that I think Americans aren't that used to eating. So we will have to have you back and talk more about truffles.
Pleasure.
Well, Susie, thank you so much for being here. This has been a great conversation with you about all of those wonderful things.
Enjoyed it immensely.
So please like us on our Facebook page, Yes to the Chef. For more information and to listen to previous podcasts of this program, be sure to visit our website, www.yestothechef.com. And we're co-host Kelly Taylor, natural chef and instructor, and Janice Escott, Cordon Bleu chef and instructor. Happy cooking, Kelly.
Happy cooking, Janice.
And thank you so much, Susie. It's been a delightful hour.
Delightful to me.